You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together. Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. Today I'm joined again. This is actually, I think, Nick, you're our first repeat guest.
Ooh.
So I'm joined here by Nick Cadiz, and this time around, instead of talking to him as an athlete, I'm going to talk to him as a nutritional coach. So hi again, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Yeah, this one, I'm really looking forward to what you have to say, because now that my team has grown quite substantially, one of the big things about the sport of powerlifting is cutting weight. And that's actually what we're going to dedicate this entire podcast to. So Nick, maybe just for the ones we haven't heard before, maybe give your coaching background a little bit, and you can even throw a little bit of your feats as an athlete in there too.
All right. So I'll just quickly summarize. I've got about 10 years of collegiate strength conditioning experience. That's how I got into coaching as a profession. But my undergraduate degree was nutrition. I love nutrition. I love chemistry and all that good stuff. And I've been a nutritional consultant for about 7 years. And my love is powerlifting. So I compete on the national scale. I finished fourth at nationals last year, raw nationals, and I will be training to get to the American record, hopefully, at bench press nationals this year.
What is the American record?
The American record is 518 pounds at 231 pounds body weight.
Okay. Big bench.
Yeah, we're gonna try. I'm also head coach of Granite State Powerlifting. We're based in Southern New Hampshire. So that about does that.
Awesome. All right. So we'll kind of get right into this. So cutting weight, it's kind of a big topic within powerlifting. Like, I know plenty of athletes that cut a shitload of weight to get down to lower weight classes. Everybody wants to cut down to lower weight classes because they believe they're going to be more competitive. However, we'll probably find out that's not always the case.
Yeah.
And I think too, where you have a growing population of females in the sport, the body weight thing becomes a, you know, it can be dangerous at times too, and it can negatively affect performance. But you know, hopefully we'll be able to hash out some things so that type of stuff doesn't happen. So Nick, let's start things off just with how much weight should a person cut? And maybe we can even go into, like, if they want to cut over a certain amount, time frame into it or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm going to let you kind of take over on this one.
Well, you're reading my mind, and you're a seasoned coach. So you understand the pros and cons of gaining and losing weight. And, you know, I myself follow a couple of guidelines when it comes to making decisions about weight classes and where my opinion of where that athlete should be. I mean, this is a recreational sport, and pretty much everybody in the sport is doing it for fun, first and foremost. So when I'm working with clients and athletes, typically we start off the conversation with, you know, where do you want to be? Where do you feel comfortable? What kind of body do you want to have? And it's, you know, there's a just on the topic of, you know, body shape and imaging and stuff like that. It comes down to the individual about where they want to be. And then competitiveness, you know, comes after that. Then we look at the facts and we say, all right, so if a person wants to look a certain way, and this isn't gender specific either, because just within my own team, I have I've got female athletes who want to gain weight or lose weight, and I've got male athletes who want to gain weight or stay the same weight. And, you know, so it has nothing to do with which gender they are, because guys have as many challenges with, you know, how heavy they want to be and how big they want to be, and if they want to sacrifice a certain kind of aesthetic look for performance, right? So that's the first thing is kind of figuring out, you know, what does that person, where are they going to feel comfortable? Because you may be a power lifter 3 or 4 times a year, but you're yourself every day, right?
Right.
And then, you know, when we're talking to an athlete about competitiveness, there's a couple of different things that we're going to look at. And first and foremost would probably be that athlete's current performance, you know, measurements, which is, you know, if their Wilks is very competitive, you know, or moderately competitive based on how long they've competing for, is it reasonable? Do they need to make any changes to their body weight anyways? You know, sometimes, even though a person may want to change weight classes, it might not be in their best interest to do so. And then if we do deem that it would be beneficial for them to change a weight class, then we would look at things like, you know, what's their build? How tall are they? You know, there's a couple of different formulas out there based on like joint circumference, wrist and elbow and things like that to try and give you an estimate about like the kind of frame that a person has. And then there's also some charts out there that have looked at the powerlifting population and said, you know, if you're between this height and this height, you should be at this weight. And so we kind of look at those things, you know. So for example, you know, if we have a guy who's 5'10" and is an 83 kilo lifter, right? And this is probably going to annoy some of the listeners jumping back and forth between kilos and imperial units.
Don't take it personally.
So I'm going to try to just stick to like one form of units, right? So let's just say this guy, 5'10", 183 pounds, you know, that's a taller, thinner lifter, and they may not be taking advantage of their capacity for muscle mass at that weight. And they may be encouraged to move up at least one weight class, maybe even two, maybe even three over the long term, you know? Right. So deciding what weight class the athlete wants to be in, they get some input, you know, do they want to be big? Do they want to be small? You know, and then balancing that with the competitive aspect, which, you know, we can look at, you know, American Nationals last year, and we could roll out every single weight class and there would be a trend of who the top performers are in terms of their height at each weight class. You see the same thing in the Olympics. You know, we don't really see any 6 foot female gymnasts, you know, and we don't really see very many 5'5", you know, volleyball players on the front line, you know. There's a reason for that, you know, because there are builds that favor those positions. So, and if you want to contribute anything, you know, or interrupt me, just go right ahead. Okay.
Yeah, no, I like where this is going.
All right. So otherwise I'm going to just power through this.
Yeah. Power through.
So what everything we just kind of talked about, that is the sort of long-term mindset, you know, more of a lifestyle mindset of what the athlete should be like. In terms of the nutritional help that I offer my athletes, you know, we have a couple of other different ways to look at it too. We have short-term weight changes, and then we have like extremely short-term weight changes. So your short-term weight changes would be like an athlete having to lose just a few pounds to be able to make their weight. Maybe they're a little bit fluffier than they should be, so they have to do just a very short-term, like legit weight cut.
Is there any like percentage of body weight or something on that? Like,
so I typically, you know, if an athlete wants to be at a certain weight class, if they're over 5%, if they're more than 5% over that weight class, then we're probably looking at a longer term dietary approach.
And what's a longer term, like in terms of
longer term could be anywhere from 6 to 18 months or so. If they're within 5% of that target weight, then, you know, we're looking at maybe a month, 4 to 8 weeks, I would say. 8 weeks being definitely on the long side. And then that gets you to the famous water cut, which, you know, I'm just going to assume that we're using the IPF rules, which is a 2-hour weigh-in, meaning, you know, you weigh in and then 2 hours later you're on the platform. We typically only account for maybe a 1-2% body mass cut due to water, right?
That's about all you can refeed anyways, right?
I mean, I've seen people do more. There are some national level competitors who have, who I've competed right next to. And I've seen a lifter lose and then regain, lose 5% and then regain 5% of their mass. You know, I will follow that up with that, you know, they didn't have a great day for themselves, by their own standards, but it can be done. And part of the water issue is that, you know, there's academic research that shows that, you know, a 2-3% variation in your body weight due to hydration, is definitely associated with performance losses, right? So we typically try not to cut more than 1-2% of the body mass just due to like a water manipulation tactic.
So if you're cutting, so you have a 48 week cut, so you're dropping calories, it doesn't matter if that's over that 3%.
Yeah. So again, so like, let's use a lifter, right? A 93 kilo or 205 pound lifter. If they're 5% over their weight class, 2% would be basically 2 pounds, right? So 5% would be 10 pounds over their weight class. So a guy weighing 215 who has to cut down to 205, if we also give him the extra 4 pounds or 5 pounds because of water, that would be like a total of a 15 pound weight cut. And I would say that we definitely need to be on our way to, you know, like I kind of like a pound a week, right? That's not anything novel. Most nutritionists and dietitians would recommend people to not try to exceed a pound a week. So if a guy's got to lose, you know, 10 solid pounds of mass, not including the water cut, you know, we should probably start somewhere. I would be a little bit more forgiving and say 8 weeks tops. You know, somebody can, you know, some of these lifters can, you know, they're already active people and they're probably, you know, there's a whole nother topic about, you know, maintaining a supra, you know, maximal weight for your weight class, right? As a training technique to get better gains during your training. So a lot of people, they're already like junking up their diet a little bit just to be that much over. So they can tighten that up really fast and be on their way. So like there's three categories of weight alterations, and it's a different athlete, or it's the same athlete at different stages of their career. Water cut is just the day of, and if you're not already within 2-3% of that maximal weight, you have no business doing a water cut. If you need to lose more than 5% of your total weight to get to that target weight class, then you have no business even trying to make that happen. Like for a certain meet that's like maybe 3 months out, then you're looking at like longer term changes. So, you know, we could probably chew up a whole hour or more just talking about any one of those specific agendas, really, you know. So I'll try to keep it, you know, not too in depth about any which one, right? But, you know, you and I, you know, we were talking about a lifter, you know, earlier, who wants to change a whole weight class, right? So sure. I'll just walk you through, you know, the process, you know, with this sample athlete, right? So with this athlete, you know, what I would do is I'd first want to evaluate them, look at their performances, look at their, you know, where they are in their lifting journey and their powerlifting journey. Also look at, you know, if they have any meet competition results, you know, what are their Wilks? How is their Wilks trending over time? Right. So we can just see, you know, what are the changes, you know, are they improving rapidly just because of like, you know, beginner gains, or are they a seasoned veteran, you know, who's very in tune with their body and stuff like that. Then, you know, I'd try to get an estimate on their body composition. If they're local, I prefer to do that myself with calipers. If it's a distance, you know, client, then self-reporting is the best that, you know, we've got, or pictures, you know, can sometimes help. Then once we figure out, okay, so biometrically, you know, height, weight, you know, an estimate for body fat percentage. And then we can say, all right, so realistically, is this person, like, for a male, if they're over 15% body fat, which really is, it's no visible abs, pretty soft, but not like extremely soft, right? That if it was very, very soft with, you know, like not really a lot of visible muscle, that would be upwards of like 20% body fat. That guy, you know, probably really shouldn't be focusing on a very extreme weight cut. They should be looking at a longer term recomposition, right? Okay. Because you're going to sacrifice too much of their strength on a cut, and that's going to be counterproductive to their goals, most likely, unless this is a person who isn't planning on competing anytime soon, you know, and you have time to either, you know, do a quick cut and then build them back up again, right? Then once we've figured out, you know, how, like, if they're how much fat mass they have to lose really is what it's all about, right? So if we have this this person, let's call him the 220 pound guy who wants to cut down to 205, and he's 20% body fat, right? So that means he's got 40 pounds of fat by my quick math, right? He could probably lose about half of that. That would be the goal, getting, you know, cutting that body fat in half. So he's about 10% body fat, right?
Right.
So this individual, now what we have to establish is, well, what are they going to eat? Right. Now there's all kinds of calculations for determining, you know, how many calories a person should be eating. And there have been times in my career where I leaned more heavily on those, but again, kind of touching back to the, this is a recreational sport for most people, even if they want to be extremely competitive. And it's just not, like, we have to make sure that there's going to be compliance with the diet. That's the number one thing. If there's no compliance, then there's not going to be any achievement. So I've actually found that, you know, basing a performance diet, you know, off of the self-reported diet, we would start off with a self-reported diet, where there's a much higher likelihood of there being compliance, right? Okay. So we would, sense. Yep. So we'd have this person, this 220 pound guy, report their in food intake and beverage intake for 2 to 3 days of, you know, quote unquote, normal eating. And that includes, you know, any junk food, any fast food, any homemade food, any alcohol, you know, whatever goes in their mouth really should be reported, because, you know, that gives us a baseline. Like, if this person is maintaining weight at 220, then, you know, we need to look at that, you know, because now we have an idea of how many calories they're used to, what their eating pattern is like, how many meals a day, how big are their meals, you know, all of those things that, you know, if we just run in here and just blow them out of the water, okay, you used to eat 2 meals a day. Okay, now you're eating 6. You used to have a drink every, you know, every week on Friday night. Well, you can't do that anymore. You whatever the case may be, you know, I mean, classic is like, oh, you don't like fish, you know, too bad. You know, you're going to be eating fish and broccoli for the next 28 weeks. That just doesn't work, because there's no compliance, right? So the athlete, you know, reports their meals, and, you know, we get an idea. Okay, so he's eating 3,000 calories, let's say. And you say, all right, well, that doesn't sound like that much, you know, for a 220-pound athlete, but he has a sedentary job. He works out only 3 times a week. He's not burning too many calories, but, you know, he is still making strength gains. So we want to preserve all of that, right? And so that's where we would start with their baseline diet. I would probably, with most people, the things that I find myself changing, you know, most often are, you know, increasing protein intake, decreasing fat intake. Usually, you know, powerlifters don't tend to be very big drinkers, because they identify themselves as athletes, and most people understand that alcohol can, yeah, is very disruptive, you know, on an athlete's body and metabolism and hormones and everything. So, you know, there's not really a whole lot of that, right? But the bottom line is getting them to something that's just a little bit better than what they were doing before. And then with my athletes, we will then, you know, we'll check in every week and we'll monitor, you know, we'll just have them hop on the scale once a week. I don't really care about daily fluctuations and good day, bad day and stuff like that. I just want to get a weight every week. And, you know, we will also check in once a month and we'll do the rest of the measurements, the body composition, stuff like that. And, you know, for this person who needs to lose 20 pounds, really, right? Because he's got way too much body fat, right? So even though he's going to come in a little bit lighter as a 205, you know, that's where he's probably going to perform better. You know, we're going to make these changes on a weekly basis and a monthly basis, you know, to make sure that he's still getting productive workouts and he's still getting stronger and he's still getting more competitive as he loses his weight, right?
Okay. And so how long, so if he's 220, he's dropping down to 205, this would be a longer term.
Yeah, this one, right? In particular, you know, would be, I would say like an intermediate, you know, that somebody who's fairly dedicated, you know, and stays on point with their diet could probably do that with a minimal disruption to their training progress. They could do that in 6 months or so, you know?
In the giant scheme of things, that's not even that long.
No, it's not long at all, you know, but, you know, most athletes are doing, you know, 2, 3, 4 competitions a year. And then, you know, if you think about like the cycle of, you know, local meets to regionals to nationals to worlds, like 6 months for a seasoned athlete could be extremely disruptive if not handled well, you know, because if you miss something and then you have to, you know, if you don't make your qualifying total for nationals or you don't do nationals, that means that you have to sit out from worlds. Like you have to go to nationals if you want to go to worlds. Right. And if you're somebody who's trying to qualify for nationals, you have to qualify in the weight class that you're lifting in, or you can only qualify up. Like a 52 kilo lifter can qualify as a 57 as well if they're strong enough. And they post that 57 kg qualifying total, but a 57 cannot qualify as a 52, you know? So, that's really important that these things be handled strategically, you know, because you can't cut down, you can only bulk up.
Right. And so say, you know, at the beginning of the year, he does a meet, qualifies in the 93s. So if he's going to do other meets that aren't nationals, right? So obviously in nationals, right, he's going to cut down. Would you just have them just step on the scale instead of cutting?
Yeah. So this guy in particular, I would say, all right, so let's rewind the time a little bit and say that we started this in January and nationals is in October. So he's got 10 months. I would literally say that, so we're going to clean up his diet and we're starting in January and we're just going to focus on improving the quality of his diet over time. And honestly, I would not have him cut for anything, not change anything to his diet whatsoever, even if we did a meet in March, May, and July, right? So we're doing 3 meets on our way. Only would I then say, this guy has got to weigh about 210 by the end of the summer.
Okay.
Right? So like at the end of July, beginning of August, he's got to weigh 210. And as we get closer to that deadline, then, you know, we would make more aggressive changes if we need to. And then furthermore, you know, 4 weeks out from raw nationals, I would say you have to be within like 2 to 3 pounds. I would like to see them at 2 to 3 pounds above their weight class, not more than that.
Regardless of weight class. So if it was a 52 kg female or a...
Yeah. So I kind of, you know, mess up my words a little bit. Like the percentage like is, you know, still, you know, 1 to 2%
over. 1 to 2%. That's right. I do.
So like a 57 kilo, that's 125 pounds. I would not want to see them more than like 127 pounds, you know, 4 weeks out from their meet.
Okay. And is that more because you want their weight to be stable while they're training so that they're kind of, their body's kind of used to the leverages and the,
well, the thing is you have to look at every calorie as a it's fuel for your recovery and it's fuel for you to get stronger. And so you want to train in a calorie surplus for as long as possible, right. You know, that's one of the things, like, you know, as we get closer to a meet, like at that, you know, 8 weeks out, 6 weeks out, 4 weeks out, we definitely employ calorie and carbohydrate cycling and stuff like that, you know, which is just a term meaning that, you know, we like look at the individual days of the week and prioritize nutrients based on what the demands of that day were.
So like higher carbs on training days.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Higher calorie, higher carb on training days, lower carb on recovery days. You know, you could even,
how low would you go on the recovery days for carbs?
You know, it's tricky. I treat every person individually.
Okay.
You know, so, but what I would say is, so like I had a lifter who, you know, most of my lifters don't fill out their weight class. So I'm trying to beat them into gaining weight, you know? You know, I did have one lifter in particular who we employed some carbohydrate cycling towards the end of their prep, and the high carb and low carb was about a 50% difference, right? Okay. So that could be like a 100 grams or, yeah, like 100 grams on a lifting day, or 50 grams on a non-lifting day, or it could be 200 grams on a lifting day or 100 grams on a non-lifting day. It all depends on, you know, where that person is and what their lifestyle's like and where their overall diet is.
And what the training looks like, I'm sure, too.
Yeah, because, you know, I've had two people who are exactly the same size and almost exactly the same body composition have a 500 calorie difference in, you know, per day in what they eat. And the logic there is mostly behind, you know, activity level. One was doing just a lot more work on a daily basis than the other one. But that one of the issues, you know, I think today is that we have a lot of people who, especially with social media, you know, it's the food pornography thing to the nth degree. You know, people take pictures of these obscene meals and present it like, you know, they're eating all of it, or, you know, maybe they're, you know, whether they claim to eat it or not or whatever, but, you know, or somebody comes online and they say, oh, you know, I'm 140 pound, you know, ripped female and I eat 3,500 calories a day. And everybody goes, oh my God, I wish I could eat that much. And da, 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 da. I'm a 235 pound man and I eat less than that. You know, it's like, you do what needs to be done. That's it. If you need to eat more, you eat more. If you need to eat less, you eat less, you know? And that's at the end of the day, you know, that can be very difficult for some people, you know? So it's hard to say, you know, exactly, you know, for what weight class would certain nutrients be in what measurements, but you get the idea, you know, like a 20 to 50% difference on a daily basis is more than enough.
Okay. So 4 weeks out, they need to be within 1 to 2% of their weight class.
Yeah.
And then when would you, so do you do water loading or do you just drop off all water like 24 hours before?
For the water cut?
For the water cut.
Well, you know, that's one thing I'm experimenting with, a few different varieties. Me personally, as an athlete, I have not had much success with the water cut. I've tried to do it. And I just can't stick to it because I'm miserable. You know, I work with people all day long and I can't take breaks in the middle of sessions, you know, every 20 minutes to go to the bathroom.
It's bloated and uncomfortable.
Right. Well, you know, part of the premise of the water load, you know, the way that I see it personally is twofold, right? So so we'll talk about the water load then, right? So, meets on Saturday, right? So you got count backwards, Friday, Thursday, Wednesday, Tuesday. Starting on Tuesday, a typical water load would be to like double your water, right? So if a person drinks a gallon of water, they're going to compete on Saturday. On Tuesday, they double their water to 2 gallons, right? Okay. And then on Wednesday, they do the 2 gallons. On Thursday, they do the 2 gallons. And then on Friday, they would drink maybe about a half a gallon from wake up to about noon, and then probably cut all water for the rest of the day. Also, you know, trying to just cut sodium, right? So no high salt foods, don't really not salting any of the cooked food that they make, you know, marinades and stuff like that. And then come in the next morning and weigh in and hopefully have lost like 1 to 2% of their body mass, right?
It's exactly what we do.
Yeah. So,
and obviously, you know, low weight foods, like no fiber.
Right. You know, and things that you don't want, things that might bloat you, no, like beans and, you know, things like, right. Or foods that like milk, things that tend to cause reactions in a lot of people. So just very simple digesting foods. One of the things that a couple of my athletes are playing around with right now is, you know, adding some sodium to the water load, because the secondary function of the water load, as I see it, is to actually bloat, not just, try to get your body to increase your rate of excretion, right? Which is the way that, you know, is what I see the major benefit of the water load being, is just getting you used to going to the bathroom, you know, urinating, and then you cut the water and you just keep urinating, right?
Right.
But if we sodium load a little bit at the beginning of that water load, then you bloat your body and you have even more to excrete, right?
How much sodium are we talking?
That's kind of what we're playing around with. But I think that if you're going to double your water, you should maybe increase the sodium by for the extra gallon, maybe have like an extra 2 grams or, you know, 2 to 3 grams of sodium. Cause you're doubling your water. If you don't double your sodium, you're going to be peeing a lot, right? Which is ultimately the end goal, right? But we're trying to see if adding a little bit of sodium at the beginning to just let you bloat a little bit more will in turn result with even more excretion as you go into
the actual cut.
Right. And then obviously coming out of the cut, you know, you want a lot of sodium and a lot of carbs and, you know, that sort of thing to try and retain as much fluid as possible after the weigh-in.
Right. So after the weigh-in, so we did the water load, we did the water cut, we just weighed in. What's the first thing that you would have them do for the refeed?
So the beginning of the weigh-in as per IPF rules is about 2 hours before, or it's exactly 2 hours before lifting is supposed to start.
When they show up, right, Nick?
Right. Well, yeah, it happens whenever they show up. I would like to see my athletes try to have some kind of a solid meal that early. If they can't eat it because of nerves and stuff like that, I've never, you know, I've had issues with that in the past. Then you just do the best that you can. But, you know, we want to see a variety of things, right? So some starchy foods like bagels, potatoes, breads, Cliff bars, stuff like that. If you can get that stuff down, that's good. Everybody's favorite gummy bears and Sour Patch Kids and stuff like that. That's good too, you know, for the sugar aspect, right? Cause you're trying to keep your blood sugar up, trying to get as much,
glycogen,
you know, you're trying to refill glycogen stores if you're low, right? If you did some kind of diet.
Can that happen within a 2 hour window?
Not fully. But you can
a little bit.
First of all, you get sugar circulating in the bloodstream, right? So your body's not going to be breaking down as much of the glycogen that you have.
Right.
And, you know, just like your whole, like the whole pre-workout supplement market is designed around nutrient uptake, right? And so, you know, we may not be exactly recreating glycogen in the muscles, but, you know, we're certainly going to be causing a vast absorption of sugar and salt and proteins, you know, that are gonna keep you at the peak performance, right?
Okay.
Only drawback is, you know, eating too much and getting sick and stuff like that.
Right.
So, you know, that's why we would have like a little bit of food at the beginning and then try to taper it off and, you know, also contribute fluids like, you know, some Gatorades and water and some people like Pedialyte and stuff like that. That can also be helpful.
So one of the things that I was always told was after they weigh in. So I have everybody, they just chug a liter of Pedialyte because bloat allows your stomach contents to empty faster. Is this true?
I can't speak on that exactly. I know that, you know, your stomach has an ejection rate, right? So if you fill it up with water, your body, I believe, you know, can clear fluid faster than solid, right? So that would make sense. My only concern would be just, you know, I mean, have you ever, you must have walked into the gym one day and tried to squat and like your belt just like wasn't sitting on your stomach right because you were too bloated from your mom's lasagna or whatever the heck it was.
Absolutely.
Oh my God, like I don't know if I can hit these squats to depth because I'm just so right. So there can be, you know, every person's a little bit different. Like I said, you know, I know a lifter who did an all around 18 pound swing, you know, at one meet as a sub 200 pound lifter. And they were miserable, but they, for them, you know, they could pull it off. Me personally, as an athlete, I hate the bloat. I have not been able to dial that in for myself and feel comfortable. So I've never really water cut as a lifter.
I think for the majority of my lifters with that bloat, like some of them like it for the squats, but then they can't get down to the bar and deadlifts. Like it's never really like worked out well for an entire meet, but it might've worked out well for a very small part of it or something.
Yeah, I don't know. And that's where the practice comes in. And, you know, you figure out what your individual lifter likes and, you know, what they can actually accomplish that day. You know, so for example, like the way that I look at the Gatorades and the Pedialyte and the candy, those are much more essential for a lifter that gets like really bad, like nerves, and has trouble eating. You know, I've had some athletes who like, no matter what, they show up on meet day and they can't stomach a thing. And so having them sip on Gatorades and trying to get them to just, you know, I'll be in the back and I'll be like, you know, five Skittles, go, like just get five down right in between attempts and like, you know, just to try to keep their blood sugar up and that sort of thing.
That's actually like, I prefer like, I mean, I could eat something beforehand, which I typically will do at a meet just because I lift in the afternoon, but like throughout the meet, I can't eat either. So like, I just, I sip on Gatorades the whole time.
Yep. And you know? I think that that's, that works well. I think that's a great substitution.
Yeah. Just free up some blood sugar. So, and you have them continuously like throughout the entire meet, they just keep sugar is more important than protein or anything else, right? Just keep.
Yeah. Well, you think the duration of the meet, you know, hopefully is going to be less than 3 to 4 hours. Right.
Right.
And then you have the whole adrenaline effect, you know, powerlifting is an interesting sport because, you know, it's very like, there's a great variety in your emotional state as the day goes on. You know, you're depleted, then you're bloated, then you're nervous. You go out, you hit your opener, and then you sit for 10 minutes. Then you do your next one. Then you sit for 10 minutes. Then you do your next one. And then you've got a, you know, probably a 30-minute break before your next attempts. And so it's like you get out there. Like I'm sure, you know, most people have the experience of like bonking in the middle of a workout, right? And you're just like, you know, you got half your workout done. And you're like, oh my God, how am I going to get through this? My head's killing me. You know, you feel kind of like cold sweats and stuff. Yeah. And those are symptoms of like low blood sugar, right? So, if we can just stave that off by just, cause you're not, the protein isn't really going to help you that day in that competition.
Right. Exactly.
The fat isn't really going to help you in that competition. I mean, you might get some, you know, oxidative, you know, energy from the fats, but I mean, overall in terms of preserving the mental health of the lifter, right, their blood sugar needs to be stable. That's the way that I see it, you know? Starting off the day right after the weigh-in with like a decent meal, something that's actually real food, and then just trying to just keep supplementing with a little bit of candy or fruit or Gatorade or whatever they can put down, you know, until they get done their last attempt on deadlift, and then they can go collapse, you know, whatever.
Right. And make sure they're not getting overly full, but comfortable.
Right. Right. And then we're not talking about like slamming back a whole, you know, 18 ounce bag of gummy bears. You're just talking about like a handful here, a handful there, you know, just like munching, grazing a little bit during the meet to just make sure that, you know, there's sugars that are entering entering the bloodstream, you know?
Okay. That does, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Like the overall like energy expenditure in a meet, I feel like the majority of the fatigue. Yeah. I mean, granted you're taking 9 attempts, you're lifting heavy, but like the overall volume of that day is not too high, but like the psychological, like ramping up and coming down and ramping up and coming down and ramping up and coming down. Like I feel for me, like at the end of the day, I'm like, I'm done. Mm-hmm. Like, and I feel it's more like psychological and like, I won't take any like pre-workouts or anything. Cause like what you were talking about, that crash, like I feel half of them like fuck up my blood sugar or something. But like all of a sudden, like once it wears off, I just feel like I'm done unless I pound another one or something.
Yes. Yes. And I've never really liked the caffeine for meat day simply because, you know, I mean, maybe doing a coffee or caffeine to start the day to help you kind of get up for that first lift. Is fine. Usually the adrenaline is so high throughout the day though, that you don't really need to caffeinate. Like I feel like the people who use the pre-workouts and the stimulants, you know, to me, that seems a little over the top. But the biggest mistake that I see on meet day is people falling off between attempts and between lifts. You know, they may be great and they start pounding back all the food that they packed, you know, right after weigh-in. And then next thing you know, like we're getting into squats and then they kind of stop paying attention to it because now they're lifting, right?
Right.
But it's very important to just keep up with that. A little bit at a time is better than a huge bolus right at the beginning of the competition.
Okay. And just keep like a steady stream rolling the whole time.
Yes.
Like, okay. All right. That's great. So I'm going to ask you one question just because Nick Santangelo,
yep,
swears by his, orange juice and a quarter teaspoon of pink Himalayan sea salt. And I was just wondering why, like, that's what he uses for pre-workout and,
sure.
I forget where he saw it and stuff, but why that might be like an effective, doing it. And I actually like it too. So
if I would say that the formula would be complete with a rounded teaspoon or tablespoon of creatine monohydrate and some caffeine. Now you got a shake there.
Okay.
If I'm going to just like, okay, what is it? It's sugar. It's lots of fluid. There's a lot of minerals in the, I don't know exactly, you know, the pink salt. I don't know why that's special. It's sodium at the end of the day. There's sodium in there. And actually one of the first big lifters that I looked up to, he would actually bring a similar thing. He called it his homemade Gatorade. And he would bring a gallon of water that had like 3 teaspoons of salt. It would have 2 like tablespoons of creatine monohydrate in there. He'd, you know, have caffeine with it. And he'd put some like, I don't know, Tang or some powdered flavor, you know, drink in there. And that's fine. I mean, all of that stuff is good. Caffeine, carbs, sodium, and creatine are probably like the best things you could have before a workout.
And creatine, it's something that should be in there all the time, right? Because if you remove it,
So creatine, in my opinion, is fantastic, and I think everybody should use it. I mean, there's plenty of safe sport certified options of just plain old creatine monohydrate out there. And creatine's great because not only does it help you with your, you know, with your phosphocreatine system, right? Your energy within the muscle cell. It is also another, you know, tool that helps bring water into the cell. And the more water there is in the muscle cell, the better leverage that muscle cell will have, right? That's one of the reasons why dehydration can reduce force production, right? So your muscle cell being bloated is a good thing. The actual muscle cell, we're not talking about like your gut being full of food and water and stuff, right? And so, yeah, the creatine monohydrate, it's cheap. And I would take it every day, you know, at least, you know, depending on how big you are, I'd say, you know, under 200 pounds, you know, 5 grams a day. And if you're over 200 grams, at least 5 grams a day, maybe up to 10 grams a day. Put it in some orange juice with some salt before you work out would be great. I mean, my pre-workout is 12 ounces of black coffee. I used to put maltodextrin in there, about 50 grams, 25 to 50 grams of whey protein, right? And I'll throw a little bit of salt in there as well. Just a scant, you know, teaspoon. And that's been my old faithful for many years.
So for me, what I'll do now is I'll take the orange juice and the salt. I've been doing that for about a month, pre-workout. And then I have like intra-workout carbs. So I'll have like a Gatorade or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I was going to add in creatine, would I add it in with the orange juice or should I add it in with the actual, the Gatorade I'm taking intra-workout?
I don't really think that it matters.
Okay.
Frank.
Would it taste better?
I would slam it back with the pre-workout. You know, okay. I think that, you know, the way I look at creatine is, you know, I take it every morning. I have, you know, any of my athletes who, you know, want to, you know, take supplements and stuff like that. I recommend that, you know, they start their day, you know, with creatine and then they put in some creatine before they work out as well. I think that creatine is more effective taken pre-workout than post, but you could do it pre, you could do it post, you could do it, you know, you could dose it out probably 4 times a day and demonstrate that that's effective as well. You know, I think that having a daily intake of it is the most important thing, your daily exposure to it.
Okay. But it's cheap enough. I'll grab some and I'm going to try that out.
Yeah. $15.
Yeah. Right. And it probably lasts what? At least
3 months or so.
3 months. Yeah. All right. I'm definitely doing that. So like for closing thoughts, since we were talking about cutting weight,
yep.
I think it'd be good to touch upon on when it's not appropriate to cut weight. Cause I think too many beginners in this sport are concerned about weight classes instead of just gaining some skills as a competitor, stepping on the scale, whatever, and just lifting.
Well, so this is what I'd say, right? So I'm just going to jump in right here. It's never a bad time to improve your diet. Never. Okay. So no matter where you are on the spectrum of life or powerlifting, it's never a bad time to look at your diet and say, what could I be doing better here? As far as your body, though, I would say that, you know, first of all, within the first year, for anybody who has just started powerlifting, I'd say it's inappropriate to compete. After they've done, you know, 2, 3, 4 competitions and they start setting their sights on some really significant personal bests and maybe they're creeping up on stabbing distance of the national qualifying total, maybe it's state records, whatever the case may be, only then would I think that it's appropriate. You know, if a person's sitting at, like, again, our 205 pound lifter who's too big and really, you know, just a little bit too fat, right?
Yep.
That person would have to say, okay, I'm going to be more competitive if I shed this extra weight. Like I'm sitting at a 370 Wilks. And if I cut down or let's not even talk about Wilks, let's say they're totaling just within 25 kilos of that 205 pound qualifying total. That's a no brainer. They say, okay, now I'm going to lose the weight. I'll qualify and then I'll move on and I'll just grow as a 205 pound lifter.
Right. What about if, because, you know, some of the qualifying totals I think are kind of low and I know they are going to go up. So what if you have a lifter, it's been lifting less than a year, but has a chance in their first or second meet to qualify? What would you do?
If they're that competitive and it's really important for them to go to nationals this year, then I would, if they're driving the bus on that, then I would work with them. Yeah.
Okay. All right, cool. I think the same. I mean, if somebody wants to gain that experience, it's a life experience regardless, like traveling out, competing. I think it's great. Obviously, as long as it's done well.
Yep.
So, Nick, this was awesome. I'm literally going to have to listen to this like 3 more times because there was so much information. Like my wheels are turning in my head. And let everybody know where they can reach you out on the internet.
So my nutrition consulting business is NutriFit Consulting, and the powerlifting business is Granite State Powerlifting. We're on Instagram and Facebook, and that's where you'll see us most often.
Awesome. And make sure you follow me on Instagram, KWCan, our team, Precision Powerlifting Systems. Nick, this was awesome.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Awesome. All right. Stay strong, Boston.